We've been making the point that each of us has a story about the way that we came to God. And Ron's story of how he came to God is not my story. And Frank's story is not my story. Kim's story is not my story. I don't want to leave you with the impression that that means that there are a lot of ways that we can come to God, because that would be untrue. Jesus makes a statement in the 14th chapter of the book of John that I want to kind of focus on tonight and come to an understanding of what it means to come to God in different ways. So Jesus says, "Don't let your hearts be troubled." Of course, he's talking to his apostles. This is shortly before he's going to be arrested in the garden, and he has to give them some final instruction. He says, "Don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust in me also. There are many rooms in my Father's house. If that were not true, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. I go and do that, I will come back. I will take you to be with me. There you will be also where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going." It's a figure that's drawn from probably the bridal occasion among the Jews. A young man would take a wife only after he had prepared a place for him and his wife to live. The place that they would prepare was usually attached to the father's house. Extended families tended to live in one very large dwelling. And so Jesus is borrowing that figure, I think, and he says, "I'm going to get your dwelling ready, and then I'll come and get you." And that's why you have the parable about the bridegroom coming when no one knows that he's coming, because he had to finish the house. And once he'd finished the house for him and his wife to live in, then he would come and get his betrothed. And that's kind of the figure that Jesus is borrowing. In God's house, there are a lot of places for me to live with those that are my bride. And so Jesus is saying, "I'm going to prepare that place." Thomas then says to him, "Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way?" Jesus answered, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father also. From now on, you do know him, and you've seen him." And Philip said, "Lord, show us the Father. That'll be enough for us." Jesus answered, "Don't you know me, Philip? I've been among you such a long time. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Don't you believe that I'm in the Father? Don't you believe that the Father's in me? The words that I say to you are not just my own. The Father lives in me. He's the one who is doing this work. Believe me when I say I'm in the Father. Also believe that the Father's in me, or at least believe what the miracles show about me. What I'm telling you is true. Anyone who has faith in me will do the things that I've been doing. In fact, he'll do even greater things. That's because I'm going to my Father. I will do anything you ask in my name. The Son will bring glory to the Father. You may ask for anything in my name, I'll do it." Now, I said Jesus makes a shocking statement in a way. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me, or through me, as some translations have it. I began to reflect on this, and you know, I think there are very few people that I've ever met, maybe no people, who would say, I really want to be with Satan in hell. I really want to prepare myself to go there. That's the ultimate goal of my life, to find myself in hell. But I don't really think that I know very many people that are like that. I've preached a lot of funerals, one way or another. Sometimes I preached funerals for people that I didn't even know. I met with the family when I could, and every family asked me, I want some assurance that my loved one is with God. I never had anybody say, I really want you to point out that my loved one spent his whole life getting ready to go to hell, and that's what he wants to do. Does that make sense? In your experience, have you met people that would say, I really want to go to hell? I just haven't. I did meet one person who, to his credit, I think was the most honest person I've ever met. He said to me over breakfast one morning, I know I'm going to hell, so I'm going to make the most of my life while I'm here. That's the only person that I know who's ever said anything like that to me. And I suppose there are other people who would say the same thing. It's kind of the, you know, live life for all it's got, die young, and leave a good-looking corpse. But I don't know very many people that would say that. I think, in general, people want to be with God in heaven. There is this general knowledge that this life is not all that there is. Now, they may not understand everything that there is to know about heaven, and I'm sure that I don't understand everything that there is to know about heaven, but I think in general, people want to be with God in heaven. And what Jesus is saying is, no man can come to the Father except by me. Now, when I say that there are a lot of ways that we can come to know God, that's just an acceptance of the fact, that just an acknowledgement of the fact that we all start in different places. Sometimes we start by thinking that I can know God, I can be acceptable to God, I can be with God in heaven ultimately because of my family connection. And I'm sure you've known people that were like that. The Jews were the ultimate example of somebody that said, I'm a Jew, and because I'm a Jew, I'm going to be with God in heaven. Right? But I think the point Jesus is making in John the 14th chapter is, you're taking me out of the picture. You're trying to come to God through ancestry or through some family connection, and it doesn't work that way. You can't come to God that way. We spent some time talking about the restoration movement in this country in the early days of the restoration movement. One of the things that we noted was that they were trying to figure out what to do about people who were the children of godly parents Because in most New England towns, you couldn't own property, you couldn't vote, you couldn't, in some towns, you couldn't even live there unless you could prove that you were in good standing with God. And so they had to figure out how to deal with these children of godly parents. What do they do with them? So what do you think? Have you encountered many people that kind of have this notion that it's a family connection that's going to get you to heaven? In the extreme, it could be, I'm going to heaven because I married a good woman. Okay? And my ticket to heaven is punched because Kim is going to heaven, and that's enough. Thoughts? You no. See that takes Jesus out of the picture? Yeah, go ahead.
No.
It's not going to work.
Each person is responsible for their own salvation. And they have to take the steps, or they have to be faithful, but they can't do it for anyone else.
Right. And like I say, the ultimate example of this is the Jewish nation. They felt like they had salvation because they were Abraham's seed. We have Abraham to our father. And that's what it takes. That's not going to do it. And the real problem is it takes Jesus out of the picture and instead puts ancestry in his place. So that would be the equivalent of Jesus saying, you can come to the Father through me or through ancestry. Yeah, Carol.
The only ancestry connection that I can think of is when I had a student who was killed, and he had been showing an interest in being a Christian. I think it was Mormon, got a hold of him and said, well, if you come with us, we can pray his soul into heaven. So that's the only connection that I see, is that they pull people back in that way to, we can pull our ancestors back in and we can pray for them and get them so they're in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. And I understand that people have a strong family connection. But that's not what Christianity is about. That's not how you establish a relationship with God. Fortunately, I have parents, godly parents, who taught me about God, but that was not what was going to help me establish a relationship with God. Any other thoughts? Ron, you look like you had something to say?
No.
No. Okay, Carol.
Jesus also said that you had to deny father and mother and brother and sister. So, I mean, he told them, you're going to have to love them less. And so he put the onus right on it that you have to love him most.
Okay. Okay. Kim.
However, this concept of ancestry throughout history has been very, very powerful. You heard stories of threats. If you don't follow this tenet, we will go to the cemetery, in the Catholic cemetery or whatever, and dig up your ancestors. You will not, your family will not be entitled to this. Well, that's very, very powerful in terms of control. And sometimes I think, like you, I was raised by godly parents. I was raised in a home where I was introduced to Christ from birth, right? And so it's sort of my ancestry. And I come and I have a wonderful legacy of faithful Christians that I come from for many generations, and I'm very grateful for that, and very grateful because it did help me come to God and come to Jesus. And so it's sometimes I think even those of us who have accepted Christ, we put a lot of stock in this is my legacy. This is who I am and my identity because of ancestry without really realizing that we're doing that. Because it's very, very powerful. I'm not sure that's exactly what Jesus was telling them here about the, you know, that, but I do get the point. I do understand it. And it's a very powerful tool. It's a powerful tool that has been used to control people. Because that connectedness with our ancestors and our ancestry and with who we are and our own identity, our self-identity, is so powerful and so strong. So I can see I have a really a lot of compassion for these Jews that really came in contact with Jesus, and they're struggling with, wait a minute, you know, why do I need this? I'm a Jew. I'm favored by God. So I kind of get it. But anyway, I just wanted to say that this is extremely powerful, and I think it's really easy for me to kind of discount it. And at the same time, I probably revel in it and rest in it because I feel very, very blessed with the legacy that I grew up in. And yeah, hopefully have passed down to my children, and they're teaching their children about God and to love God and how that relationship is so personal a part of their lives. I'm delighted. I'm just overjoyed that some of my grandchildren are living their lives for Jesus, and others are learning to do so. So I'm proud of that. I'm very, and not proud in terms of a prideful thing, but I that's part of my identity in Christ. And so that can be very powerful, and I can get it tweaked in my life if I'm not careful.
Yeah. Yeah. And the kind of the flip side of it's not really the flip side, but a part of this is that we sometimes don't value teaching our children about God, because we kind of feel like it's their birthright. You know, they're going to grow up and they will have a relationship with God. And we don't teach our children. And preachers are really bad about doing that, about not teaching their own children. That's kind of like the cobbler's family, or the last people that have shoes. I'll go out in the middle of the night to teach somebody about the gospel, but I neglect teaching my children. I don't know if I guess that they'll get it by osmosis or something, or, you know, we have to teach our children as much as we teach anybody else about God.
But it's that danger of relying on that ancestry.
Yeah.
And saying that, you know what, you know, I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, somebody asked me why I didn't do something. And I said, well, that's my religion. And when I told my dad I said that, he said, no, that's not the answer. It's not because it's your religion. And so and then he sat down and used that as a teaching moment to say, no, you don't adopt it just because it's your family religion. He said, that's very dangerous. But I think we kind of start to do that a little bit without even realizing it. So it's very powerful.
Well, I think we have to reflect on this. Yeah, Mandy. Uh-oh.
No, you're on the hot seat right now. No, I had this very interesting conversation that I have been stewing all day about with one of my students driving home from the Duck game last night. Now, mind you, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, so I'm trying to not be punchy in this drive. And somebody said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm writing an email to the church. And he goes, why? He goes, well, because on Friday, I am paying the church to be baptized in the name of some of my dead relatives to get them into heaven. He's paying, he is a 15-year-old young man, paying for six of his dead ancestors to get into heaven. And the rest of the car laughed at him. And they picked up on how asinine that idea sounds. But in that moment, my brain could not wrap around how am I going to talk to this kid? And now I've got to go study to figure out how I'm going to talk to this kid. But I personally was flabbergasted with that idea that they're teaching that they can pay to have their ancestors get to heaven. And then the question came up, well, do they get a memo while they're in heaven that they've been baptized for? Mm-hmm. And they said, yes, they were communicated to. And I went, whoa, hey, I like post-its from God. You know, come on, send them to me. Somebody said, well, what if they reject that baptism? Because they weren't baptized when they lived here on earth. And he goes, well, no, it's because they weren't members of the church. And they said, well, what if they reject that? And he went on this other tangent. So I got a lot to learn because it doesn't make sense. I just flabbergasted.
I think the key is you can't replace Jesus.
Yeah.
Nothing can take Jesus' place. So you may come from a background totally different than I come from. But ultimately, we're going to converge, not at heaven, but we're going to converge at Jesus. And that's what's going to help us create the relationship with God. Yeah, Carol.
It's the truth that Jesus is the way. But what he was doing here, he's trying to be very plain to these apostles who weren't hearing all of the things that he was saying. But he's saying that because it's true, but because they are going to go through a tremendous upheaval of having to say, oh, being a Jew isn't the way. And so he's being very plain, very blunt, and saying, you know, you've been looking at me. Can't you see this? I mean, they could see the miracles. They knew he was from God, but then they don't connect all the dots. And this is one of his first pleas to really make them say, you know, you've got to listen. And I think he was really glad that the Holy Spirit was going to be talking to them later and bringing this up into their minds so that they could feel strengthened.
Yeah, Kim.
Well, the term the way with early Christians meant something. And I think that's why Jesus chose the words that he did. You know, in Acts, the movement, the Christianity movement was referred to as the way. And Paul, when he talked to these Christians, he would say, you are in the way. And so I think when Jesus is pointing that out, it's not just that you're in this movement, but you're in this movement because of me. And because that term is used consistently throughout the New Testament to refer to Christianity, to that whole, I don't want to use this word flippantly, but or terminology flippantly, but the Jesus movement. It was called the way. And so he's really identifying that as it's really all about me. It's all about coming to the way through the proper way.
Okay. So we're all going to converge at Jesus. Okay. There's another thing, another way that some people, again, take Jesus out of the picture and they substitute a moral life. I'm going to have a relationship with God because I'm a decent person. I'm a moral person. Now, regardless of whether I would argue that the reason you're moral is because you learned that from God in the first place, And then there's a lot to be said for that. We're going to skip over that and just try to understand that some people want to substitute a moral life for having a relationship with Jesus in order to get to God. So comments about this. You look like you're deep in thought, Bill. I'm almost afraid to ask you.
Go ahead. When this nation was founded, it was founded for religious freedom from the oppression in Europe. One of the things that one of the founding fathers, I believe, said was that these laws only work for a moral people, basically a God-fearing people. And then we would have a nation that lived a godly life. But it hasn't worked out that way. And that was taking all these different religions that were living the moral life that they saw as right, and having a nation of these people united together. And that's the largest example I can think of. And generations of people since then have grown up thinking, if I live a moral life, I'll go to heaven.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Carol?
And a lot of people who... Yeah. were taught this is the right way to do something, they, shall I say, get on their high horse. And they look at somebody that they see in a church and they say, well, I'm better than them. They're just corrupt. And so that moral life is a protection for them. They say, I'm better. I don't need any church. I don't need that. I'm still going to go to heaven. And so they base it on what they do and not what was done for them, not the gift they were given to receive.
Okay. It's still back to, we're replacing Jesus with moral life. Yeah, Faye.
Acts 10 tells us about Cornelius, who was a devout man and God-fearing. He wasn't saved until he heard the message. And it takes 47 verses to get to his baptism, but it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. Hang on to Cornelius. I kind of classify Cornelius under another category of things that people replace Jesus for. Oh, okay. But it's a good point. He did live a moral life. And so did the Apostle Paul. Lived a moral life. There's no indication that Paul ever did anything that was immoral. And most of the people that I come in contact with, that I have conversations with about a relationship with God, place that relationship with God as something that they attain because they live a moral life. And they're good people. Okay. And you can't take a moral life and replace Jesus with a moral life. It won't work. You're going to have to get through Jesus in order to get to heaven. And that, the point about grace, I think, is well taken. It's not something that you can earn. If it was morality, then it's something that we have as a wage. Heaven is a wage. It's what we've earned, something that God is obligated to give us. And that's not what it is. Yeah, Kim.
I read this quote the other day and I had to stop and look it up. So I'm glad for the internet. Thank you. So Oprah Winfrey.
Of all people.
She said, one of the biggest mistakes that human beings make is believing that there's only one way to live and that we don't accept that there are diverse ways of being in the world
and there are millions of ways and many paths to what you call God. And people listen to that because they want religion. They don't want revelation from God. It's all about themselves. And she has even said in interviews that her gospel is all about, it's humanism is what it is. It's all about the person and what they want, and that's how they come to God. But I don't understand why people listen to people like that. And these people that we consider for some reason in our culture as being so wise, and they're so powerful, and they wield that power to say things like this. And people believe it. You know, if I'm a morally good person, I'll go to heaven. If my dad and my parents, my ancestors were morally good people, I'm destined for heaven. I can do what I want to do. It doesn't matter. So it is extremely pervasive. Anyway, I just had to look up that quote real quick, and so I wanted to share that.
And the other thing that bothers me about this, substituting moral life for Jesus, is I get to define what a moral life is. Yeah. And that's the problem that we have today, because we want to say it's moral if it doesn't hurt somebody. It's moral if I actually believe this. It's moral. And, I have to tell you, I worked in the prison system. And I interacted with a lot of people who were incarcerated because they had abused women. And I worked in the male sex offender treatment program. Okay, I wasn't an inmate. I worked with those folks. And talking with them, I actually had a conversation with someone who tried to defend having a sexual relationship with a little girl who was 6 years old, because he was, as an adult, he was going to treat her with kindness. And he wasn't going to abuse her, and he was going to introduce her to the notion of sexual relationship with a male in a loving and kind way. He defined that as moral. And you can't talk them out of it. There is no way to talk them out of it. I talked with people and one person made the statement to me, I'm going to take what I want. And if you don't stop me from taking it, that means that you want me to have it. That passes as moral in the mind of a lot of people. And there are a lot of other things that are passing as moral in the mind of people today that shouldn't. They're just immoral. Yeah, Carol.
One of the things that you'll hear quite often, because people know enough about stuff, is you tell them that Jesus is the way, and if you don't believe in Jesus, you're not going to heaven. And they say, how dare you say I'm going to go to hell? It's like, I didn't say you were going to hell. I didn't make that judgment. But because they realize in the way that it's phrased that that's what it means, they want to blame you because they don't want to hear the message.
And they don't want you to tell them what moral is either. And they really don't want to be moral. Their morality changes depending upon the circumstance that they find themselves in. Yeah, Bill.
There's one thing. Morality is flexible depending on wherever you're at and whoever you're with. People don't want to be obedient to something that is a stationary, unmovable thing. something that we all do because we're here. We were obedient to God. There's a standard, a starting point. We say, I'm going to do what you said. And then I'm going to live the kind of moral life you want.
Yeah.
Instead of just making up my own, they go a long way.
Yeah.
People don't want to be obedient to something.
Yeah, we want to establish something that we can live up to. And the way of life that Jesus calls us to live is a way of life that demands a lot of us. You know, I was listening to a podcast just the other day, and somebody said, when Jesus said, if your eye causes you to offend, pluck your eye out. And we kind of roll our eyes and say, well, Jesus really didn't mean that. Okay, what would you be willing to cut off? If having your phone is a temptation, okay, and goodness only knows you carry around a phone that will give you instant access to all kinds of pornography. I read the other day that the most visited sites on workplace computers, we're not talking about the computer that you have hidden in your bedroom that you surreptitiously view things on. This is workplace computers are porn sites. Would you be willing to cut this off? To say, I'm not going to have that anymore. So maybe that's what Jesus is talking about. Maybe the thing we need to cut off is the way that so much filth gets into our house. Our television. Would you be willing to say, I'm not going to do that anymore? I need to cut that off. Just something to think about. Okay? Morality is not going to get you to heaven. Jesus will get you to heaven. So there's another way that people, and this is what I think Faye was talking about with Cornelius. Cornelius was a devout man. He was one who worshiped God. Okay? He didn't know everything that he needed to know about God, but he thought that because he was devout, he could have a relationship with God. And there are all kinds of very, very devout individuals that we come in contact, like the person that Mandy was talking about, the young man who thought that he needed to pay for his parents to be in heaven. He is a religious person. Okay? And he thought that being zealous for his religion, like Paul, like Cornelius, like Mandy's friend, and I'm sure like friends that you have, they thought that that was what was going to guarantee their relationship with God. And it's not. That's not the key. You can be religious, but if you let religion take Jesus' place, you can't get to God. It won't get you there. Okay. Dean, I didn't mean to ignore you. You looked like you had your hand up.
I was just pondering all kinds of things, and I would ramble, so I'm going to skip it.
Here's the key. You need Jesus. What Jesus provides. You don't get to have a relationship with God based on who your family is. You don't get to have a relationship with God based on morality. You don't have a relationship with God based on just being religious. You have to have Jesus. And that's the key. Now, we're all going to come to know Jesus in different ways. Like Kim said, some of us grew up in houses where our parents taught us about Jesus. And that's wonderful. Some of us grew up not having that benefit, and we lived on the street, and we didn't know Jesus. And the way that we lived was rank. That's the prostitutes and the publicans who came to Jesus. Sometimes we were involved in a religious community that didn't teach us about Jesus. Now, that's the Jews. But however we come to God, however we come to Jesus, excuse me, that's the only way that we're going to find our way to God. So we know that we come in different ways, but we all converge at Jesus. That's where we all come together. Concluding thoughts. Okay, you've got the last word.
Oh dear. Well, I find it interesting that Jesus made this statement to these trusted, closest friends, the most intimate people that he had this intimate relationship with here on this earth. And this is as he had just given them some really troubling news, disturbing news. And they're confused and they're trying to figure this out. And he's saying, don't let your heart be troubled. It's going to be okay. And as he goes through this entire discussion, and this is a long conversation, this goes on for chapters and chapters, but I love the simplicity of what he tells them. I think is comforting to them. He's giving them comfort because he just delivered a pretty harsh blow, and they're very confused. First, you have Thomas. I love Thomas. He's so honest. He's like, "What are you talking about? How can I go? I don't know. You're going someplace and you're not telling me where, and yet you're saying that I'm going to go. But how can I do that? I don't know how to do that." And I love that Thomas was just so blunt and so he felt comfortable that he could ask his master that. And then Philip, the same thing, is, "Lord, I'm still not getting this. I don't understand. How am I going to do this?" And Jesus patiently says, "You know, you've been with me all this time and you still don't see it. So hang in there. We're going to get you there. But you have to go through me. It has to be done this way. There is no other way to do it." And you know, we talk about it like, wow, that's so simple. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. How simple is that? These people have been closely intimate with Jesus for 3.5 years. They had been with him almost every single second. And they had seen miraculous things. And that's why he said, you know what? If you're having trouble with this, think back to those miracles. Think back to everything you have seen. And I think that's kind of the same way he says to us, think back on your life. Think back on all the times that you saw me act in your life and everything that I've done, and understand that I am the way. I just think that's really powerful that he said that to those people. He didn't say that to the Pharisees and the Sadducees who were challenging him. He said that to the people who were closest to him, who were obedient to him. I think that's pretty powerful in and of itself.
It's the ghost in the machine. So we're gonna spend some time talking about this concept. We have about 8 weeks or 6 weeks, something like that, until we go back to our winter schedule, and we won't be meeting on Sunday nights. But I think we can get through this discussion between now and then, and I hope it will help. So let's be thinking about that. And if you get a chance, write down your story, how you came to know God, how you came to meet Jesus, and what that meant to you. And we'll talk about some of those stories, because they are important.